from there. Okay.
Okay.
Should we have to, shall I repeat the question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should have written this ahead of time. Anyway. Hello, my name is Johannes van der Meulen of Naman, and today we're having Alex Wright in the seventh interview in a series of interviews with individuals with views that are pertinent to practitioners of interaction design and information architecture. Welcome, Alex, today.
Hi, Johannes. Thanks for having me.
Alex Wright is an information architect at the New York Times and author of GLOT, Mastering Information Through the Ages, published in 2007. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Salon.com, Harvard Magazine, and the Christian Science Monitor, among others. He has also led information architecture engagements for the Long Now Foundation, the California Digital Library, Harvard University, IBM, Adobe, Microsoft, Sun Microsystems, and others. Today we'll be talking mostly about your book, which I admire very much. And one of the last chapters is called The Web That Wasn't. What is it about?
Well, in that chapter, I try to explore the early history of hypertext. And what I really try to do is to look at the systems that came before the web and to see what we can learn from those systems. I think a lot of us tend to assume that the web sort of started one day in the 1990s, but really it was the culmination of a whole series of developments that came before. And going all the way back really to the 19th century, there were a series of attempts at creating a framework for organizing the world's information into a single accessible resource. And in that chapter, I really look back through a series of developments and a series of sort of philosophies that led up to the web, going all the way back. One of the most interesting people that I look at is a guy named Paul Otellet, who was actually a Belgian information scientist. And he worked in the early part of the 20th century, actually the end of the 19th century as well, to develop a sort of global repository of the world's information. It originally started as an attempt to create a universal bibliography of all the information that had been published since the development of printing. And in the course of trying to create this bibliography, he developed this vision for a new kind of information system that would be somewhat different from libraries as they had been previously thought of. His essential insight was that there was a lot of information that was contained inside books, and that if you could not just catalog the books themselves, but actually try to penetrate the covers of the books and try to unearth the information that was contained inside them, you could create a whole new way of interacting with that information. So he spent many years working on this project that eventually came to fruition as a project called the Palais Mondial du Mondaneum. It was actually housed here in Brussels. It was formally established in 1921. And here he developed what's sometimes been called an Internet of Paper. He developed a system that attempted to accumulate all these different kinds of information, both books and magazine articles, newspapers, photographs, posters, all kinds of different information, and to catalog it and make it available in a way that anybody could access. He actually saw this as a global repository of information. And by the time it was up and running, he had a whole apparatus set up where people from anywhere in the world could send in a query via telegraph. Mm-hmm. And he had a staff of people who would then take the query by telegraph, go research the question using the Mondaneum, and then telegraph the answer back. It was kind of like a very analog version of Google. And this was actually up and running for several years, from 1921 till about 1934. And unfortunately, in the years leading up to the Second World War, and during the war, it sort of faded to obscurity. And actually, during World War II, the whole site was destroyed in the war. And for many years, it was completely lost. All of his work had basically disappeared, and he himself died at the end of the war and was basically forgotten for about the next 30 years. And only in the last few years has he been rediscovered, and are people starting to acknowledge him as a real sort of philosophical forebear of the Internet. So it's very interesting to be here in Brussels. Actually, yesterday I traveled down to Mons and visited the site where they've actually created a reconstruction of the Mundaneum.
But with original material.
They have about 8 million of his original index cards and huge boxes stuffed with pamphlets and articles and all kinds of archival material, only a tenth of which has actually been indexed so far. They have a team of archivists going through and trying to really recreate his original vision. It's really quite a fascinating project.
Imagine that. Otley had been able to continue his efforts until now. How would the web have looked differently?
Well, it's interesting to look at Otley's work, because even though he was working in an era before computers, where the state-of-the-art technology was index cards and the network infrastructure involved telegraphs, nonetheless, his vision was actually quite sophisticated. He had, for example, developed a concept of something very much like hyperlinks between documents. And he had this idea that documents could be linked to each other in some way. And not only that, but this is where his vision, I think, is more sophisticated than the web in a way. His idea was that the links between documents could actually contain some meaning. For instance, you could say that this document agrees with this document, or this document approves or disapproves of this other document, and that the links themselves had some kind of notation with them that would convey that meaning. So in that way, his idea was actually more sophisticated than what the web has today, which is a very simplistic kind of link, where one document just links to another document, and that link doesn't really tell you anything.
Yeah, in your book, you mention another precursor to the web, mm-hmm. which also has characteristics that are inherently better than what the web has on offer right now, is Xanadu. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit about that system, which is more recent, correct?
Sure. Yeah, Xanadu was the brainchild of a guy named Ted Nelson, who was a very important figure in the history of hypertext and the web. Actually, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, has credited Ted Nelson as his direct inspiration for inventing the web. Nelson was a very interesting figure. He started work in the 1960s as a grad student at Harvard, where he began to develop an idea for how computers could work that was somewhat different from the mainstream computing industry. He felt that at the time computers were really being dominated by the whole apparatus of the computing world and academia and industry was being dominated by scientists and mathematicians. And he felt that there was an opportunity to envision computers in a very different way as more tools for personal expression or creativity. And in this sense, he really anticipated the whole idea of the personal computer. He also had this idea that these computers could be networked together, and that if you networked computers together and gave people the right tools, they could start to create whole new kinds of information. So he actually coined the term hypertext in 1965 as a way of describing these new kinds of documents that he saw emerging. And over the next 20 or 30 years, he began to articulate his vision of a new kind of computing environment that he called Xanadu. And Xanadu was an attempt to create an infrastructure for people to create and share information and to network that information together. That in some ways sort of anticipate the web, but in other ways, his vision is actually quite a bit more elaborate and you could say advanced than the way the web has turned out to be. He had all kinds of very well thought out, very complex kinds of interactions that he thought you could support between different kinds of documents, rather than the way the web works today, which is in a way very simplistic. You have one document links to another document. Mm-hmm. He thought that you could have all kinds of different relationships between documents. They could in some way be meshed together, that you could have sort of what he called transclusion, which is the idea that a particular document could serve as kind of a dynamic window into another document, and they could embed pieces of text sort of in real time. And he had all kinds of other sort of metaphors and ideas that he came out with that are really quite a bit beyond what the web does today. He really had a very different vision for how the whole thing could work, and he's actually on record as being not particularly happy with the way the web has turned out. He thinks it's a very simplistic version of his original idea.
Why did the Tim Berners-Lee take on hypertext make such an impact and not the vision of Paul Dodley or Ted Nelson, do you think?
Well, I think the key to the success of the web is actually its simplicity and the fact that it's built on open standards. So Tim Berners-Lee took advantage of an existing standard, TCP/IP, and he developed a framework, a sort of simplified markup language called HTML that was actually derived from a more complicated language called, or markup standard called SGML. And really, I think the reason the web has been so successful is because it's so easy for anyone to create a web page. It's relatively easy to set up a web server. And because it's so open, nobody really owns the standards or can effectively monopolize the infrastructure. And so that's, I think, the reason that the web has become so successful is really due to a confluence of factors to do with its openness. It was the right time. The infrastructure was in place. There were some policy changes that took place around that time, like the internet was opened up to commercial use in the early 90s, which previously it had been confined to academic and defense and military use. When Tim Berners-Lee first invented the web, it was in that context of academic research. So he developed the web as a tool to enable scientists, particularly physicists, to share research papers with each other over long distances and also sort of large sets of data. He developed it really as a way of exchanging essentially paper, you know, and that's one reason that there's the web has this sort of built-in metaphor of a page. You know, a web page is very much derived from this original idea of letting people just exchange, you know, written research with each other. Over time, as the infrastructure opened up and it became open to commercial use, you started to see companies and, you know, different kinds of enterprises adapting the web for new kinds of purposes. And over time, you started to see more interactive applications being developed, you know, so more software-like applications. And that was really not something the web was originally intended for. And so it's always been this kind of slightly uneasy fit. As anyone who does web development will tell you, there's always a challenge of trying to get an interface and a web page to behave the way you would hope it that a real sort of desktop software application would work.
There's the eternal problem of this maintaining state.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And the web's just not designed for that. It's a stateless environment. So that's, I think, one area where the web's, you know, it's been sort of jerry-rigged and you know, web developers are constantly trying to find ways around that, things like AJAX or what have you. But you know, the web, just given its predominance and the fact that everyone now has a web browser on the desktop, it's very hard to envision an alternative system emerging at this point. I think we're, you know, even though we're making incremental improvements, the web is really a great case of a technology that's been sort of co-opted into a role that was never quite intended for in the first place.
It's only this last chapter that talks about the internet. You start off your book in early biological systems. And a recurring theme is that networks and hierarchies coexist. What are the implications of that?
Well, if you read a lot of the more heated rhetoric about the web today, there are a lot of people who argue that the emergence of this global network is going to spell the end of traditional hierarchies, traditional organizational hierarchies, ontological hierarchies, national, you know, governmental hierarchies. And there's this sort of utopian idea out there that, you know, as the web takes root, it's going to lead to this very egalitarian sort of era of bottom-up systems, and that over time, you know, the network will dissolve all these old sort of hierarchical constructs that we're all kind of used to. So the argument I make in the book is that this dynamic of networks and hierarchies seeming to be in opposition to each other is not really such a new phenomenon after all, that you can actually look back in different periods in history and see, especially at these during times when a new kind of information technology has emerged, that it's often the case that it creates a period of instability where a new sort of networked movement, kind of bottom-up movement, seems to take shape. For a great example of that would be the invention of the printing press. When Gutenberg's press started to take hold, you started to see the phenomenon of people beginning to sort of self-organize. You could look at the early Protestant movement as a great example of people taking advantage of this new technology, the printing press, to communicate with each other directly.
And subvert the hierarchy.
Exactly, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. Right? Similarly, in the years that followed, there was all kinds of political instability, and you know, one doesn't want to overstate the case for the printing press, but it certainly had something to do with a period of fairly dramatic change. That for a time it seemed like a very chaotic period in the era following the invention of the printing press. But inevitably, as these networks, as networks take shape, new hierarchies tend to emerge out of them. Another example would be in the with the invention of writing about 7,000 years ago. At first, it was developed as essentially a tool for accounting, for merchants to basically keep track of their affairs.
Very much a network activity.
Very much, yeah. Very
peer-to-peer.
Bottom-up, peer-to-peer sort of interaction where people, as people started to live together in larger settlements, they started to engage in more and more commerce, and they needed tools for keeping track of their accounts. And as that activity escalated, those methods of accounting became more complex. People started making lists of things, and then there were kind of lists of lists, and then eventually there was a need for sort of organizational entities to keep track of things. So you started to see a sort of, at first, a special class of scribes kind of emerged, people who were professional accountants and later became kind of professional writers.
Like the notary publics, you know.
Exactly. People who were sort of invested with some level of trust and accountability. And around...
Comes the hierarchy.
Right. And around that institution emerged the earliest sort of... governmental bureaucracies, as in a way, governments are really predicated. You know, the modern government is really predicated on the technology of writing. So I think that's an example of where a bottom-up sort of networked system took shape, and a hierarchical system emerged out of that. So I think we see that over and over again at different periods in history as new technologies take shape. There's some back and forth between kind of networked activity and emerging hierarchies that seems to happen over and over again at different periods in history. And I think we may be seeing a similar phenomenon today with the rise of the web and the seeming rise of networked kind of bottom-up interactions.
You make a distinction between folksonomies, which is a term well understood by information architects, although it's a fairly recent term, on the one hand. On the other hand, folk taxonomies. Mm-hmm. And they are different, aren't they?
That's right. Folksonomies is a fairly recent neologism, I think it's called, made-up term, should not be confused with folk taxonomies, which are a well-established term in anthropological circles. Folk taxonomies refer to the systems that oral or tribal cultures develop to describe the natural world. So many anthropologists have devoted their careers to studying these systems. So if you go to, say, the outback of Australia or Papua New Guinea or South America or, you know, to Native American tribes, you find actually surprising similarities in the way that they organize information about plants and animals. Not only that, but these systems are surprisingly complex. We tend to think of oral cultures as being sort of culturally less advanced than us or not have the same sophistication in terms of thinking about systems, but these folk taxonomies are surprisingly refined. They're actually very similar to the kind of Linnaean taxonomy that many of us learned in high school biology class, the idea of, you know, a genus and a species and a subspecies. Almost, you know, every tribal culture that's ever been studied has a similar sort of breakdown of, you know, plants and animals, and then, you know, you have within the animal category something like mammals, and within mammals you have something like canines, and within canines you have something like dogs, and then you have species of dogs and so forth. You have this kind of hierarchical system. This is also, I think, a great example of how a hierarchy can emerge out of a network. These conceptual hierarchies emerged over long periods of time through really kind of the trial and error and a gradual consensus that emerged among a sort of self-organizing culture of individuals living together. And over time, as people collected in data about the natural world, and over generations, people sort of pooled their knowledge, and these folk taxonomies emerge out of that, and the taxonomies take on this hierarchical shape.
The number of levels is very similar.
It's invariably, there are invariably five, sometimes six levels of hierarchy, of sort of conceptual hierarchy. So, you know, like kingdom, genus, species, et cetera.
So. Where would that limit? Why is it not overall three or overall 10, do you think?
Well, that's a really interesting question. There's a hypothesis that it has something to do with our neurological wiring, that we may actually have some disposition to categorize information about the world around us in a particular way, which the argument for that is that first there's the evidence that so many cultures seem to categorize information that way, but there's also a theory of some biologists that these kinds of cultural systems emerge in concert with human biology, and that our cognitive makeup, basically our brains kind of evolved along with these constructs for categorizing information, so that we may actually have some physical wiring that makes us think about the world, you know, categorizing information in a certain way.
And because it makes us successful as a species.
Exactly. It's to our advantage to have a shared understanding of how to describe the world around us. If we're living in communities, we need to be able to reach consensus about how the world is in order to survive.
There's a fascinating section in the book where you talk about the Irish and their manuscripts. They came from a very special situation where there was the oral culture which dominated, and then quite suddenly they were confronted with books. Can you explain a little more?
Sure. It's a fascinating example of an oral culture, you know, a very ancient oral culture, coming into contact with the technology of literacy very quickly. In the space of about 100 years after St. Patrick came to Ireland, the Irish people, many of them anyway, became literate very quickly. And they were the first people to learn to read directly from books as we know them. At the time when you know, in the Dark Ages, the book was actually a relatively young technology. Previously, most forms of writing had involved scrolls, like long papyrus scrolls, or people had written in stone. And the bound book, as we're familiar with it today, was really developed at the very tail end of the Roman Empire. And as the Roman Empire collapsed, the book proved itself to be a very portable form of information technology. And so as a lot of Rome burned, a lot of Roman libraries burned, and their papyrus scrolls went up in flames, the books were actually much easier to get out of harm's way. And they tended to actually, it was the books that actually largely made it out of the empire and were dispersed more broadly. And in the years that followed, as you started to have the culture of Christian missionaries evolve, they tended to find the book a nice portable format for carrying around. And when the missionaries first arrived in Ireland, they presented this technology to the books. And the Irish, for some reason, took to it with a great deal of enthusiasm. They became quickly very enamored of books. And in the centuries that followed, the Irish really elevated the art of the book to unprecedented heights. They developed the form of the illuminated manuscript, which then came to find its way back into Europe and became, you know, it was really kind of a dominant form of bookmaking throughout the the Dark and Middle Ages, until the advent of the printing press. But the Irish really elevated it to a high form of art. And what was interesting about them was, especially in the way the Irish approached it, and this may have had to do with their having recently come from a very oral culture, a lot of the early Irish manuscripts are, it's almost like reading blogs. Like, they're very conversational. They'll have a text, and they'll be copying the text, and then they'll sort of make annotations in the margin, or they'll draw little pictures and little illustrations around the text. And it's almost like they're creating this new form. They're playing with this form of the book, and doing it in a really seemingly kind of very joyful way. But what comes out of that is really a whole new form of the illuminated manuscript. So again, if you look at the way that the Irish embraced literacy, it happened in concert with the introduction of a new technology. And as they embraced that technology, they began to explore new forms of expression. And I think you can see a very similar thing going on today with the way a lot of contemporary bloggers are starting to play with this new form and inventing a new form of expression. It's also very conversational and makes use of mixing media in different new ways. So I think there's an interesting kind of parallel there.
Yeah, what's your take on the microblog format, such as Twitter?
Like Twitter and so forth, yeah. That seems like a sort of an extreme oral culture. Like it's very, really completely conversational. One of the themes I look at in the book is the relationship between oral culture and more traditional literate culture. So as you look at the way the web is playing out, there seem to be these two cultures emerging. There's the more traditional forms of writing, which you can see expressed in things like, you know, newspaper articles or, you know, journals or, you know, more conventional long form styles of writing. And then you have this huge wave of what I think is really more like an oral culture emerging. Things like Twitter, like instant messaging, email. And then you have certain things like blogs that seem to sort of exist somewhere in between.
They're oral cultures, but they are predicated on literacy, on writing.
That's right. They're not exactly oral because they are written in type, but they seem to sort of evoke the rhythms of oral patterns of communication. So it's interesting to see, look at how those forms, how those sort of conventions relate to each other. There's a great linguist named Walter J. Ong who wrote about this topic quite a bit. He coined the term secondary orality to describe the tendency of electronic media to engender patterns of communication that are have more in common with ancient oral cultures than with more recent forms of traditional literate writings.
Gutenberg, but also Diderot, get mentioned in your book as introducing disruptive technologies, information technologies, in a way that engender important societal changes. Any clue, Alex, as to what the internet is going to do? Of course, it has already done quite a bit, but can you try to look ahead for us a little?
I'm more comfortable looking backwards, I guess. That's why I wrote my book. But I think I know better than to try to venture too many predictions. But I will say that I think that as the internet continues to play a growing role in shaping people's lives and the way we all communicate and interact with each other, I think we are going to see more of this trend towards a new kind of oral pattern of communication. And I think it's interesting to see, especially with kind of the younger generation, that a new language pattern emerging. I've heard it suggested that it's almost like a new form of kind of pidgin language being developed, where it's, you know, with all the sort of shorthand of instant messaging and the a mixture of languages and modes of communication. Yeah. And even today, you sometimes hear like teenagers saying things like LOL out loud and taking what was the sort of electronic form of communication, and now it's sort of infecting its way back into spoken language, right? So it should be interesting next few years, but I don't claim to have any crystal ball. So.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alex, for your time.
No, thank you, Jonas. I enjoyed it.